All wealth can be counted in four commodities: land and gold and slaves and ivory. We believed that the land that lay ahead of us was rich in all of these. If we were to grow strong enough to return and drive the Hyksos from our very Egypt, then we must discover this wealth in the unexplored land to which we were sailing. Queen Lostris sent out her gold finders into the hills along the river as we passed. They climbed up through the gorges and the dry nullahs, scratching and digging in every likely spot, chipping fragments off the exposed reefs of quartz and schist, crushing these to powder and washing away the dross in a shallow clay dish, hoping always to see the gleaming precious tail remaining in the bottom of the dish. The royal huntsman went out with them to search for game with which to feed our multitudes. They searched also for the first sign of those great grey beasts who carry the precious teeth of ivory in their monstrous heads. I made vigorous inquiry through the fleet for any man who had ever seen one of these elephants alive, or even dead. Though their teeth were a commonplace throughout the civilized world, there was not a single man who could help me in my inquiries. I felt a strange and unaccountable excitement at the thought of our first encounter with these fabulous beasts. There was a host of other creatures inhabiting this wild land, some of them familiar to us, and many that were strange and new. Wherever reeds grew upon the river bank, we found herds of hippopotami, lying like rounded granite boulders in the shallows. After long and erudite theological debate, it was still uncertain whether these beasts above the cataract belonged to the goddess, as did those below, or whether they were royal game belonging to the crown. The priests of Hapi were strongly of one persuasion, and the rest of us, with an appetite for the rich fat and tender flesh of these animals, were of the opposite opinion. It was entirely by coincidence that at this point the goddess Hapi chose to appear to me in one of my celebrated dreams. I saw her rise from the green waters, smiling beneficently, and place in my mistress's hand a tiny hippopotamus no bigger than a wild partridge. As soon as I awoke, I lost no time in relaying the substance of this weird and thrilling dream to the regent. By now my dreams and divination were accepted by my mistress, and therefore by the rest of our company, as the manifest will and law of the gods. That evening we all feasted on luscious river cow steaks, grilled on the open coals, on the sandbank against which the ships had moored. My reputation and popularity, which were already high throughout the fleet, were much enhanced by this dream. The priests of Hapi alone were not carried along by the general warmth of feeling towards me. The river teemed with fish. Below the cataract, our people had fished the river for 1,000 years and longer. These waters were untouched by man or his nets. We drew from the river shining blue perch, heavier than the fattest man in our company, and they were huge catfish, with barbalet whiskers as long as my arm, that were too strong and weighty to be captured in the nets. With a flick of their great tails, they ripped the linen threads as though they were the fragile webs of spiders. Our men hunted them in the shallows with spears as though they were river cows. One of these giants could feed 50 men with rich yellow flesh that dripped fat into the cooking fires. In the cliffs above the river hung the nests of eagles and vultures. From below they appeared like masses of driftwood, and the droppings of the huge birds painted the rocks beneath them with streaks of shining white. The birds floated above us on wide pinions, circling and swaying on the heated air that rose from the black rocks of the gorge. From the heights, flocks of wild goats watched us pass with regal and disdainful mien. Thanos went out to hunt them on their airy crags, but it was many weeks before he succeeded in bringing back one of these trophies. They had the eyesight of vultures, and the agility of the blue-headed rock lizards that could run effortlessly up a vertical wall of granite. One of these old rams stood as tall as a man's shoulder. His beard flowed from his chin and throat to sweep the rock on which he posed. His horns curled upon themselves from mighty crenellated bases. When Thanos finally brought him down, it was with an arrow shot across a gorge 100 paces deep, from peak to pinnacle of these rugged hills. The goat dropped into the gulf and twisted over and over in the air before it hit the rocks below. Because of my passionate interest in all wild things, after he had skinned out and butchered the carcass, Thanos carried the head and the horns home for me. It took all his vast strength to bring down such a burden from those murderous crags. I cleaned and bleached the skull and set it up on the bows of our galley as a figurehead as we sailed on into the unknown. The months passed, and below our keels the river began to dwindle away as the inundation abated. As we passed the sheer headlands, we could see the height of the river measured upon the cliff where all the previous inundations had left their watermarks. At night, Memnon and I sat up on deck as late as his mother would allow us, and together we studied the stars that illuminated the firmament of the sky with a milky radiance. I taught him the name and the nature of each of these fiery points of light, and how they affected the destiny of every man born under them. By watching the heavenly bodies, I was able to determine that the river was no longer taking us directly into the south, but that we were veering towards the west. These observations stirred up another heated controversy amongst the scholars and the wise men of our company. "The river is taking us directly to the western fields of paradise," suggested the priests of Osiris and Amun-Ra. "It is a ruse of Seth. He wishes to confuse and confound us," argued the priests of Hapi, who up until now had exerted undue influence over our councils. Queen Lostris was a child of their goddess, and it had been generally accepted by most of us that Hapi was the patron of our expedition. The priests were angry to see their position weakened by this wayward perambulation of the river. "Soon the river will turn south once more," they promised. It always appalls me to watch how unscrupulous men manipulate the wishes of the gods to coincide with their own. Before the matter could be resolved, we came to the second cataract. This was as far as any civilized man had ever ventured, and not one of them had reached further. When we scouted and surveyed the cataract, the reason for this was abundantly evident. These rapids were more extensive and formidable than those we had already negotiated. Over a vast area, the stream of the Nile was split by several massive islands and hundreds of smaller ones. It was low water now, and at most places the bed of the river was exposed. A maze of rock-strewn canals and branches extended for miles ahead of us. We were awed by the grandeur and menace of it. "How do we know that there is not another cataract, and then another, guarding the river?" those who were easily discouraged asked each other. "We will expend our strength, and in the end find ourselves trapped between the rapids, without the strength to advance or retreat." "We should turn back now before it's too late," they agreed amongst themselves. "We will go on," decreed my mistress. "Those who wish to turn back now are free to do so. However, there will be no vessels to carry them, nor horses to draw them. They will return on their own, and I am certain the Hyksos will bid them a hearty welcome." There were none who accepted her magnanimous offer. Instead, they went ashore on the fertile islands that choked the course of the river. The spray from the rapids during the flood and the water filtering up through the soil during low ebb had transformed these islands into verdant forests in stark contrast to the dry and terrible deserts on either bank. Springing from seeds brought down by the waters from the ends of the earth, tall trees of a kind that none of us had ever seen before grew on the silt that Mother Nile had piled up on the granite foundation of the islands. We could not attempt a transit of these rapids until the Nile brought down her next inundation and gave us sufficient depth of water for our galleys. That was still many months away. Our farmers went ashore and cleared land to plant the seeds that we had brought with us. Within days the seed had sprouted, and in the hot sunlight the plants seemed to grow taller under our eyes. Within a few short months the Dara corn was ready to be harvested, and we were gorging on the sweet fruits and vegetables that we had missed so much since leaving Egypt. The muttering amongst our people died away. In fact, these islands were so attractive and the soil so fertile that some of our people began to talk about settling here permanently. A delegation from the priests of Amun-Ra went to the queen and asked for her permission to erect a temple to the god on one of the islands. My mistress replied, "We are travellers here. In the end we will return to Egypt. This is my vow and promise to all my people. We will build no temples or other permanent habitation. Until we return to Egypt, we will live as the Bedouin, in tents and huts." I now had at my disposal the timber from those trees we had felled upon the islands. I was able to experiment with these and to explore their various properties. There was an acacia whose wood was resilient and strong. It made the finest spokes for my chariot wheels of any material which I had so far tested. I put my carpenters and weavers to work on reassembling the chariots that we had brought with us, and building new ones from the woods and bamboos that grew on the islands. The flat bottom lands were several miles wide on the left bank, below the cataract. Soon our squadrons of chariots were training and exercising upon these smooth and open plains once more. The spokes of the wheels still broke under hard driving, but not as frequently as they once had. I was able to entice Tanus back onto the footplate. However, he would not ride with any driver but myself. At the same time, I was able to complete the first successful recurved bow upon which I had been working since we had left Elephantine. It was made from the same composite materials as was Lanata, wood and ivory and horn. However, the shape was different. When it was unstrung, the upper and lower limbs were curved out and away from the archer. It was only when the weapon was strung that they were forced back into the familiar bow shape. But the tension in the stock and the string was multiplied out of all proportion to the much shorter length of the bow. At my gentle insistence, Tanus finally agreed to shoot the bow at a series of targets that I had erected upon the east bank. After he had shot 20 arrows, he said little, but I could see that he was astonished by the range and accuracy of it. I knew my Tanus so well. He was a conservative and a reactionary to the marrow of his bones. Lanata was his first love, both the woman and the bow. I knew it would be a wrench for him to acknowledge a new love, so I did not pester him for an opinion, but let him come to it in his own time. It was then that our scouts came in to report a migration of oryx from out of the desert. We had seen several small herds of these magnificent animals once we had passed the first cataract. Usually they were grazing upon the river bank, but they fled back into the desert as our ships sailed towards them. What our scouts reported now was a massive movement of these animals, such as took place only very occasionally. I had witnessed it just once before. With the freak occurrence of a thunderstorm in the desert fastnesses once in 20 years or so, the flush of green grass that sprang from the wet earth would attract the scattered herds of oryx from hundreds of miles around. As they moved towards the fresh grazing grounds, the herds amalgamated into one massive movement of animals across the desert. This was happening now, and it offered us the chance of a change of diet and the opportunity to run our chariots in earnest. For the first time, Tanus showed a real interest in my chariots, now that there was game to pursue with them. As he took his place on the footplate of my vehicle, I noticed that it was the new recurved bow that he hung onto the rack, and not his faithful old Lanata. I said not a word, but shook up the horses and headed them towards the gap in the hills that offered us a route out of the narrow valley of the Nile and gave access to the open desert. We were 50 chariots in the squadron, followed by a dozen heavy carts with solid wheels that carried sufficient fodder and water for 5 days. We trotted in column of route, 2 vehicles abreast and with 3 lengths between the files. This had already become our standard travelling formation. To keep down the weight, we were stripped to loincloths, and all our men were in superb physical condition from long months of work on the rowing benches of the galleys. Their muscled torsos were all freshly oiled and gleamed in the sunlight, like the bodies of young gods. Each chariot carried its brightly coloured recognition pennant on a long, whippy bamboo rod. We made a brave show as we came up the goat track through the hills. When I looked back down the column, even I, who never was a soldier, was affected by the spectacle. I did not clearly recognise the truth then, but the Hyksos and the Exodus had forced a new military spirit upon the nation. We had been a race of scholars and traders and priests, but now, with the determination of Queen Lostris to expel the tyrant, and led by Lord Tanus, we were fast becoming a warlike people. As we led the column over the crest of the hills and the open desert lay ahead of us, a small figure stepped out from behind the last pile of rocks where it had been lying in ambush. "Whoa!" I reined down the horses. "What are you doing out here so far from the ships?" I had not seen the prince since the previous evening, and had believed that he was safe with his nursemaids. To come across him here on the edge of the desert was a shock, and my tone was outraged. At that time he was not quite 6 years of age, but he had his toy bow over his shoulder and a determined expression on his face that mirrored that of his father, when Tanus was in one of his most intractable moods.
"I am coming on the hunt with you," said Memnon.
"No, you're not," I contradicted him. "I'm sending you back to your mother this very instant. She will know how to deal with small boys who sneak out of the camp without telling their tutors where they are going."
"I am the Crown Prince of Egypt," declared Memnon.
But his lip trembled despite this weighty declaration.
"No man durst forbid me. It is my right and my sacred duty to lead my people in time of need."
We had now moved on to dangerous ground. The prince knew his rights and his responsibilities. It was I who had taught them to him. However, in all truth, I had not expected him to exercise them so soon. He had made it an affair of royal protocol, and it was difficult, even impossible, to argue with him. Desperately, I sought for an escape.
"Why did you not ask me before?"
I was merely biding for time.
"Because you would have gone to my mother," he said with simple honesty, "and she would have supported you as she always does."
"I can still go to the queen," I threatened. But he looked back into the valley where the ships were small as toys, and he grinned at me. We both knew that I could not order the entire squadron to drive all that way back.
"Please let me come with you, Tata," he changed his tune.
The little devil was attacking me on all fronts. I found it impossible to resist him when he exerted all his charm. Then I was struck with inspiration. "Lord Harrop is the commander of this expedition. You must ask him."